Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Barbell Strikes Back. I'm your host, James McDermott, and today my guest joining me is Jim Storch. Jim is a weightlifting coach and an athlete from upstate New York. He's been a part of the sport for several decades, lifting and coaching, and he has accomplished quite a lot, including holding 5 National Masters American records, and he also recently completed the Masters Grand Slam in 2019, winning the Masters National Championships, the Masters American Championships, the Masters Pan American Championships, and the Masters World Championships. So I'm super excited to talk to Jim. Jim, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Awesome. It's great to have you on the show. Great to talk to you. You know, this is take 2 for anyone listening. We had some technical difficulties, and I told you earlier that you were one of the top people that I wanted to interview on this show, and I'm glad to have you on.
I'm glad to be here, and it's an honor to be on the show.
Yeah, so Jim, I want to make this show all about you. So let's go back in time a little bit, and let's talk about how you got into weightlifting.
I wanted to do it for as long as I can remember. Probably the first memory I had of weightlifting specifically was when I was 6 years old. The 1972 Olympics were on TV, watching it with my family. And I looked at the TV and I said to my parents, I want to do that. And they said, oh, aren't you cute? And then 4 years later, it was the next time I saw any weightlifting. And it was, again, the Olympics. And I'm 10 years old. And I said, I don't know. And they told my parents, I want to do that. And they said, you're too young. But they probably bought me a weight set for Christmas of 79. So I was 13 years old when I started lifting weights, and it's been quite a process figuring out how to do it, because back then there was no internet or YouTube or anything, so they had to be lucky enough to be in an area where there was weightlifting activity, other people, coaches, what have you, to help you learn how to do the lifts, or there was a magazine, but it was still photos, and it's hard to learn the lifts real good from that. It helps some. It was still difficult. Or you had to teach yourself, and teaching yourself back then when there wasn't any resource is not the best way.
Yeah. That's pretty amazing that you saw at the 72 Olympics, and then you had to wait 4 years to see weightlifting again, because it's not like it is today. Like you said, you know, there wasn't YouTube, there wasn't Instagram where you're just exposed to it all the time. If you type in a word onto the search engine, there wasn't even Google. So it's almost like it was fate that 4 more years went by and you saw it in the Olympics again.
Uh-huh.
And now that takes us to, you know, you've gotten an interest in the sport. You're finally able to dabble in it. You've got a weight set. How long before you started to get into competing and diving deeper into the weightlifting community?
I went to my first weightlifting meet in June of 1984. So it was, again, another 4 years, basically 4 or 5 years, four and a half years at least. And by then, I had taught myself how to snatch for years. An interesting part of the story also is, so the 72 and 76 Olympics, I don't know what they really showed, but all I remember was like the clean and jerk. In 72, they had the press. I don't know if that's what they were showing. I'm 6 years old, so I don't know.
Yeah.
By the time the 76 Olympics rolled around, they were just doing snatch and clean and jerk. And again, I think they only showed the super heavies doing clean and jerk. That was pretty much it. That's all I remember. So at that point in time, I knew nothing really about lifting weights. So when I first got the weight set, they bought me a bench press also. So I would do some curls, I would do some presses, but for the most part, it was my workouts revolved around the bench press and the clean and jerk. But the clean and jerk that I was doing was not really a clean and jerk. It was a continental reverse curl rugby push press thing, because I had no clue. I just thought they were picking it up for your shoulders and they put it over the head. So I was doing this terrible flip movement, but I had no clue. And I think I finally found a library book. It was published in the 50s. It had drawings of the split style of this, which, and then I was already doing squat snatches and squat cleans myself anyway. But in 82, I saw, it was, ESPN was a brand new television station, and they actually showed it later to me, and they were doing snatches and finger jerks. And I saw them doing snatches, I was like, what is this? I had no clue what they were even doing. And after the contest was done on the television, I ran home, and the top was under my exercise bar wider and started trying to figure out how to snatch.
And so you started to snatch. Did you ever dabble in the split snatch at all? Or was it always squat snatch?
Early on, just squat snatches. I have trained them off and on. Just as when you train as long as I do, you need to mix things up occasionally. You know, if I was training for the Olympics, I probably would not have done a whole lot of split snatch stuff. But
yeah, you've got to keep it. You've got to keep it fresh. Got to keep it exciting. Yeah. I know you told me once, and the number is definitely much higher now, several years later, but you told me once when I met you that you had done, I think you had said at the time when I met you, you had done 133 meets.
Yes, and I am up to 148 now.
My goodness. So that's quite a bit of experience. How has your approach doing weightlifting meets changed over the years, you know, from being a younger lifter to now completing the Grand Slam? I'm sure there's all kinds of things you've changed in terms of your mental preparedness and your confidence. Can you kind of talk about that evolution a little bit?
The biggest change was, you know, the first time I went to weightlifting meet, I knew what snatch, clean, and jerk were. I found a little bit of literature about the rules. I had a general idea, but not a specific idea at all. So I had no idea about counting attempts and warm-ups. I knew you'd warm up, but I didn't know how to time them. So the very first meet, I just, oh, okay, it was here, and they started warm, so I just warmed up and waited until it was my turn and hoped I was ready and just didn't have a process. And I did fine because it was my first meet. And I'm actually, even right from the beginning, I am a weak lifter. Just as an example, my best clean and jerk before I went to the first meet, was 230 pounds because I had a mix of pounds and kilos when I was training. At that contest, I did 115 kilos. I did a 10 kilo PR.
Wow.
And my best front squat at five, I did front squat 107.5 kilos. So I go to the meet, I clean and jerk 115. I thought, hey, now I just clean and jerk the front squat. No, I still clean front squat 110.
Was that just because of the atmosphere of the meet, or better equipment, or what?
Mostly atmosphere. I go to the meet and it's game time and they're always coming back. So I have improved my mental approach over time. The competition, again, just always revved me up. And I always did. I was always able to focus the contest. Over time, I learned more about how to make an approach for the lifts. It's become more consistent on making lifts. And I still struggle with snatches, even in training. I tend to get better in weeks than I do in training.
Yeah.
I've been training, I'll miss lifts, I shouldn't miss, and I don't want to meet. I'll miss warm-ups, but I'll make every lift on the platform. I don't always make every lift on the platform, but I'll make more lifts on the platform sometimes than I do in the warm-ups or in training when that's in the meet. The best way to do it, as a coach, it drives me nuts, so let's just do that. But that's my reality.
Who were some of your coaches and mentors eventually once you started to get more involved in the community? I'm sure you showed up at a meet and there were maybe some people that, you know, took you under their wing, maybe?
Many people were good with advice and good advice at this. But it's, you know, very short term, you have to meet, you have to do this, this will help you. And then, you know, some of that was better than others, but generally speaking, people I've met, you know, that I've met, I didn't really get any hands-on direct coaching on how to improve my lifts and things like that until I went to one of Leo Tom's weightlifting camps down in New York, Pennsylvania. The first year he had Morale in New York, and then he missed started being around, but, yeah, I think it was 85, 86. The first time I went to a weightlifting camp, the first time I had coaching other than my own, or the guys I had talked into doing it with me, who, you know, I taught them how to lift, so they were kind of helped me. But So Leo Patton was my first weightlifting coach. Because one, just a few years after that, he formed his team, and I was one of the early members of East Coast Gold. And even then, Leo was 4 hours away, so I still didn't get a lot of hand-back coaching, but just a camp, a week-long period of time getting hand-back coaching helped immensely.
Just here and there. And has he been your coach essentially ever since?
Pretty much.
Wow. So that's a long commitment to a relationship between an athlete and a coach. And I remember, yeah. Seeing him working with you at, I think it was the 2017, Masters Nationals in Buffalo. It was either 17 or 18. And I was like, oh, I had no idea that Jim was coached by Leo. I really didn't even think, you know, at the time, like who your coach would be, but this all makes sense now.
And there have been other people that have helped. Lee is the one who's given me the most help and has helped us have the most impact. Dave Miller had coached me for a period of time. And that was good. Still, you know, being in the mix. Dave Fleming has given me a little bit of coaching. But I was Dave's original coach and Jared's original coach, too. So both the Flemings started out with me. In fact, that's how I ended up coaching Jared Fleming is because I had coached Dave.
Yeah. What was it like when you saw Jared Fleming break the American record in the snatch? Were you there, or did you just find out about it after?
I think I might have watched it. I think they had a webcast, didn't they?
Yep. They probably they were broadcasting it probably on YouTube.
Yeah, so I think I watched it, and it was very exciting. It was very happy for him. I think of myself as a coach, as a guide. I don't own the athletes. I'm there to help them. So Jared did all the work to make that happen. I guided him. I helped. I wasn't the only one. He had help from other people. As his career progressed. But I'm definitely the one who started.
Yeah, so it must have been nice to be like remembering like him as a little kid coming in for the first time, and you know, you never know what someone's going to do right away, unless maybe you did. You're like, wow, this kid is going to be, you know, a champion and a record holder and do great things someday. Did you have any of those feelings off the bat?
I know the Flemings in the family. I know Jay's grandfather was a strong man back in his day. Not like an active strong man, but I've witnessed some things that just proved to me how strong this man was. And I thought Sean David then, when he was lifting. It came as no surprise that Jared had an aptitude for it. So Jared started lifting when he was 10, weighed about 80 pounds. And I want a new lifter, especially to have good form, which, you know, initially you're first showing them, then the form is not going to be great at the beginning. But as long as they are maintaining decent enough form, I don't automatically restrict, no, you cannot go above this weight. We'll see how it plays out. I think the very second workout that he ever did with me, again, 10 years old, weighs about 80 pounds. I said, I'm going to show you how to front squat. So he would not get me out of the correct position, and, you know, I correctly tell me that, you know, you do this, you got to keep your back straight, you got to squat deep enough, all that. He front squatted 50 kilos like there was nothing on the bar.
Wow.
And when he's weighing, it's so 80 kilos, it's about 37, you know, give or take.
Yeah.
And you could have done more, but I stopped it there. Because I figured that was heavy enough. But I had him warm up, I hit the bar, that was good, put a little weight on. The next thing I know, it's 50 kilos on it, and it's like I've added no weight.
He just had that natural strength.
Yeah.
So I like that. Like, you know, your approach is essentially you're not gonna try to hold an athlete back. As long as everything's looking good, you're gonna let them, you know, hey, it wasn't in the plan today to go for a 1 kilo PR, but are you feeling good? Let's do it. What's your approach with someone when they first start? Like, someone comes in, you're like, Jim, I want to be a weightlifter. I want to be a champion. Where do you start that person?
Well, I look and see how well they move, what their body awareness is. Just, you know, are they sort of athletic already, or are they, you know, are they starting below where I'd like to see a base, or are they starting at or above a good start point? And a lot of that is the flexibility, the mobility aspect of it. Because if you cannot hit proper positions, then I can't have you. I can't even do certain lifts until you can hit proper position. So I kind of assess and see where they're at. And just a little bit of clarification. If there are times where I will hold a lift back for, you know, for a specified, if I'm in a fully period where I'm doing this, not that I won't let them creep out of that a little bit, but I will not let them do that every single workout.
Yeah, that's when you can kind of get into trouble every single workout and you start missing more than you're making.
I think that the old so-called Bulgarian training that people were trying to do, I think if you're in the process long enough and you get to that point and your body will tolerate, I think it is possible. It's a push, and very few people can even do it. And I'm against taking any illegal substances myself, and I don't have any of my athletes do anything like that. But I can see where that, in that kind of a program, that might be a necessity. So since I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to train people that way anyway.
Yeah, is that...
But then, if somebody wanted to do that, that would be years later. You're not going to start at the beginning of doing that.
Yeah, that's when you're an advanced athlete.
Yes.
So you draw some inspiration from the Bulgarian system, you know, when someone is ready for it. Like, that's something that might be achievable when you're at an advanced level in the sport. For a beginner, would you say it's more of like a more of an American style, more of a Chinese style, focusing on a lot of accessory lifts or accessory strength things?
I would say more like the old style Soviet block training, the Russian training from before. I bought some of the books that Chernyga was selling. They probably still sell them. A lot of good information there. I'm influenced by that. So I don't follow their book exactly, but I definitely utilize it. And I don't always do this, but the things I would have other people do may be influenced by what I do myself, but what I do, I've done it there for so long that I'm my own thing. So I've experimented on myself more than I've experimented on my athletes.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to do it, where you... Yeah, I think that's a great way to do it, where, you know, of course, you know, like close to 50 years in the sport and being, you know, influenced by so many different people and so many different things. It's like John North says, you know, you're going to grow your melting pot. You're going to take a little from here, a little from there, and it kind of becomes its own thing.
And I mean, you got to carefully, but you don't go wrong with that. But yes, you know, you gotta try some different things. I love evidence-based things. Those things have not been researched, and I cannot wait until the evidence shows what works, because then I never would have gotten to do them.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. And I know for myself, I experiment a lot on myself and along with my athletes. And I think there's just as much value in learning from that as there is from like the research out there. And then you got to look into where the research came from.
Uh-huh.
And do those people even lift? You know, like the meme, do you even lift?
And just to retouch on the Bulgarian thing a little bit. So one of the things the first time I kind of learned about, I always understood that I may or may not be hearing the whole truth to this. But the supposed idea on it was, you go heavy every base level workout, you do singles. So just as my own little experiment, inspired by that, I did for 7 days straight. And I don't remember this was a high percentage for me. It was 95, 98 plus percent. Every single day, I did a double in the squat with what would have been about 188 kilos.
Wow.
And I was able to do that for a full week. And what I noticed is, after a few days, I was kind of achy and sore when I'd warm up and start, but the soreness would go away during the workout. And by the time I got to the seventh day, I was fatigued. I was tired, I could tell, but I still could do two. I think, I don't remember what my best up to that point had been. But I think the 97, 98% range. And I was probably in my late 20s, late early 30s, I don't remember. But I did a 415 pounds, 188-ish kilo, 188.5, whatever it was all to. I warmed up and did a bubble 7 days in a row just to see the effects of that work. And
Do you think that if you would have continued it, you would have eventually started to adapt and it would have been, you know, like, so I see like someone out there like Pat Mendez squats 600 pounds every day. And I know several years ago, that was like all the rage. Everyone was talking about squat every day. And I know I did it for a while where I was kind of alternating between the back squat and the front squat, pretty much maxing them both out every day, but at least at a minimum goal of getting over 300 pounds on each lift. And, in the beginning it was rough, and then it starts to turn into, you know, it starts to turn into, okay, it's just a normal thing. And the thought of not doing it also started to like creep into the psyche. It's like, I got to squat. Like you almost started to crave it too.
Yep. I think maybe if my life circumstances had been a little different, I was working 12-hour shifts at my job. So I would work 6 to 6:15 at night, go right from work to the gym, work out, and I would get to, so I was not really sleeping enough, and I was definitely not getting enough recuperation, what's the word I want to use?
Recovery?
Yeah, that fits. So I did that in spite of that, and I think ultimately if I tried to keep pushing it, something would have given. I think I would have broke myself if I had tried to continue that. I don't know if it would have taken 14 or 21 days, probably less than that, but I think I would have gotten hurt.
Yeah.
Because I did not have sufficient time to fully recuperate.
Yeah, that's something that definitely, you know, you got to take into consideration. Like you're working, you know, 6 a.m. to 6 in the evening. That's a full day's work. And then those athletes that maybe some studies are based off of, they're not necessarily doing that. They might be going to the gym multiple times a day, but they still have like their recovery sessions, government-sponsored meals, like so many things.
Yeah, I have wife, kids, house, trying to pay bills, trying to work. I wasn't working 12 hours every day, but I was averaging at least 4 to 5 hour shifts a week, and sometimes it was more. And then I'm trying to work out on top of that, and I wasn't doing much else.
Yeah.
So yeah, I had some time for the wife and kids.
Yeah. So how does the way that you coach the lifts affect your programming of the lifts? You know, if you have someone who's, you know, like, all right, Jim, I can lift 3 days a week. Are you like breaking up the lifts? Are you having them lift every day? Are they doing accessory exercises at different percentages? What's your style like?
First, I try to, as much as possible, I'll have a conversation with the lifter and see what it is. What are the goals? Why are they doing it? If they want to compete at whatever highest level they possibly can, and they still only can train 3 days a week, I mean, in some regards, that it's going to limit what their top end is going to be. I mean, I think sometimes people tend to train too much, but I think ideally, depending on the person in recovery, I think 4 or 5 days a week is very reasonable. 3 is much less than that. You're only going to gain so much. I don't think it's impossible to make good gains on 3 days a week. But I think that's really about a minimum. Four times that I can only train 2 days a week, and I still make gains four slow. So what I would do is find out what they think they really want, what they think their problems with this are. I would try to see what I see and see if what they think is wrong matches what I think is wrong. I'm not just looking at what's wrong, but what's right, and see if their impression of their lifting matches mine.
I think that's very interesting. What you just said, not only see what's wrong or feel it out, but also to see what's right. I think a lot of people don't really think about what's going right and what the other person's perception is in their lifting when they go about programming. It's mainly all geared towards, okay, well, what do we got to fix?
Right. And, you know, ignoring your weak points is a mistake. It's a huge mistake. But so is ignoring your strengths.
Yeah, definitely. 100%.
So, I mean, your weakest link, you need to address it. You absolutely need to do that. But where your strengths are, you've got them.
Yeah, you can't like try to bring your squat up at the expense of, you know, your overhead strength. And so you're just not going to do overhead strength anymore because you're good at it. And then you get really good at the squat strength. But then when you go back to press overhead or you do your jerks, it's kind of diminished a little bit.
Yep. Exactly. And that's, you know, especially people who are relatively new, they don't always have a full concept of what they should try to do. And I still, if I'm helping somebody, it's still their journey, not mine. I mean, I can, unless it's, I'm absolutely opposed to what they're doing, then I'm going to tell them, maybe you need to find somebody else. Because, you know, why do you need me if you don't want to do what I'm telling you to do? But if somebody says, I have to do curls, I want to do curls, and I know, and I'm not opposed to curls, but if you're spending so much time on curls that could be more better applied to actually doing lifts, you know, that's a little bit of a sticking point. But if they really want, I want stand clean jerk more, but I want bigger arms, you'll adjust, because it's their journey, not mine.
And it's got to be fun for them too, right? Like if they enjoy, if doing curls is the thing that motivates them to come in and grind through the snatches and the clean and jerks and all that other stuff, but that little cherry at the end, doing those curls, that's what keeps them going, then of course you got to do that.
Yeah, and that's the thing too. I am not coaching the world team.
Yeah.
Do I think if I had, you know, if my life had gone that route, do I think I'd be capable of it? I do believe I could do that. But it's not where my life's gone, and I do this for fun. And now I can think I can still guide somebody to that point, but they're the one who has to want to do it.
Yeah, they have to want it.
Yeah, so if they don't want to, then I'm not going to turn them into it.
Well, yeah, I think that comes back to, like you said, having that conversation with the athlete. Do you want to be a Masters National Champion? And they might say no. And if it's no, then it's like, all right, well, then what do you want to get out of this lifting? And even if it's just for fun, there's nothing wrong with that. I tend to think that all goals are equal and level. You know, like the same person who's got the goal of wanting to lift recreationally and getting a PR every now and then is just as important as the person who wants to go to the Olympics, because that's their own personal, you know, thing that they want to achieve in with their lifting and in their life. So it's like everyone's valuable. Everyone's a herd.
It's at least valuable to them, and that's who I'm dealing with. If I'm dealing with them, I'm dealing with them as an individual. To them, it's important. It matters. Now, that doesn't mean everyone else in the world sees it as important, and that's, they don't have to.
Yeah.
I'll give you a quick quote, if I can remember how I worded it. But I just put on Facebook, and I don't know if you even saw it, something along the lines of, you don't have to see the world, no. You don't see the world the way I do, and you don't have to.
I like that.
So I think, in some ways, my coaching is influenced by that. You know, if this is just something we can't agree on and it doesn't work, then there's other people who can coach you. If it's within the broad range, I might try to guide you more towards my coaching, but it's still your choice ultimately. And, you know, and ultimately, too, if I feel like I'm wasting my time, I got better things to do.
Well, now here's another question for you along the lines of that. You know, I know as a younger coach, especially when I was just getting into it, you know, you spend so much time with a person and then when they leave, it's almost like a breakup, you know, it affects you because you're like, oh my goodness, I can't believe this person is leaving the team, or they, you know, they don't want to talk to me anymore, or things like that. And even if it doesn't end badly, it could just be, you know, they don't want to do it anymore, or they switch gyms or something. And it had nothing to do with you. It's still hard to kind of remove that emotional element from it, you know, when you spend so much time helping someone and giving someone so many resources. Like, how have you moved past that?
Part of the way my personality is, being that I'm the guide, my perspective on life is, live it while you can, because it only lasts a while. So, and coaching is a relationship. it's a step right, it's a good positive relationship. You help the person. And my goal has always been, do I want to make somebody a good midwifer? Absolutely. But I'm helping a person with their life. I'm hopefully giving them skills so that they're able to more than just lift their weights. So my hope is, yes, if someone moves on one way or another, they may well miss them some, but if I've influenced them to help them, and help them have a better life, they can go on, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Especially if they go out and move beyond. That's wonderful.
Yeah, and they go out there and they're successful.
Yeah, I can live a little vicariously.
Yeah.
I'm not going to make any claim to the work they've done because I can direct, I can guide you. But the other ones just want to do the work. I can't lift a forum, otherwise it's just me lifting.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. You know, I had a conversation with a past lifter the other day, and they thanked me for one of their medals. And I was like, I didn't do anything. You had to go and do the lift. You know, like, I don't know why you're thanking me for your medal at that competition. Like, I was just there. I watched you do it. I didn't actually lift up the weight, you know.
But they know you did help. And we lifted for you, and it's respectful. So, you know, you can downplay it. I think that can be a right thing to do. Because it is, they did succeed. They're the ones who did it. So, yes, you did help, or else... If you're not helping, then what's just helping the coach out? And you are helping, James, I see.
Yeah, true. Yeah, it seems like it's always, you know, like you see things, you know, where high-level lifters split from their coach and things like that, you know, and then it happens to you, and it's like, okay, well, how do I react to that? How do I deal with that? So it's good to hear your perspective on this, and hopefully, you know, that will definitely help me. You know, it's something I try to improve upon, and I'm sure it'll help other coaches listening too. On it's not necessarily the end of the world, especially if you make it end the right way, where you can still be friends, and if you see each other at a weightlifting meet, you can still say, "Oh, hello, how are you doing?"
Yes, it's all a process, and the end is part of the process. Whether the end is because they just stopped lifting, or they moved on, or whatever. And I really think that if I've done a good job as somebody's coach, they'll move on one way or another, and have fond memories. And we'll know that, yes, I did help them.
Yeah. That, you know, that kind of makes me think about is, like, another way to kind of look at this whole thing is maybe you help an athlete and you get them to a certain point and then they need to move on, and it's nothing personal, but they move on. But what they're also doing is they're living their part of the process, but they're also allowing you to go on with your part of your process as a coach, because them leaving might be the reason that you have more time for the kid in the corner who ends up being the next Olympian.
Exactly.
So it's like the forks in the road, on which way you got to go.
Yeah. And let's step back to Jared for a moment. I knew that if Jared stuck with this long enough and was interested and had all the potential I initially saw in him, that there would come a point where he very likely would have outgrown our situation here. Again, do I think I could have pushed him even farther? I do. But you need the environment. And eventually, if you're the top of your, if you're the cream of the crop, you're the top of your little pond, you can't go any higher until you move to a bigger pond.
Yeah, you need bigger fish.
Yeah, you need bigger fish. And I mean, lifting as much as this is an individual sport, when you're around other people trying to do the same thing, it feeds the fire for everyone.
100%.
So Jared, you know, graduating high school, you went to college, you was around a whole bunch of other people that you couldn't be exposed to here in our little hometown. So that was it. I don't want to say I was looking forward to him being gone, but I was looking forward to him going to that next level that he pretty much helped grow. And again, I honestly think that I have enough skill as a coach to take him farther, but I did not have the environment that he needed.
Yeah, he needed to chase the atmosphere. He needed to be around.
Yeah.
I know he was around Kendrick Ferris at one point, and being able to have someone like that, you know, of that caliber to try to beat and try to push yourself against. That's an invaluable experience.
And it's one thing to have two videos and, you know, occasional, but when you're in the gym right next to that person, that's a big, that's that day in, day out environment, you know, immersed in it, that we just couldn't do here.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's like if Jared wanted to clean 180, it helps a lot when he sees someone else in person on the platform next to him to do it, and then realizes, oh, that is possible. I can do that. I'm just as tall as him. I'm just as big as him. I can definitely do that.
Yep. Well, so there are people, it's not impossible. There are people that can train alone and be world champions. There's just not very many of them.
Yeah. It's incredibly hard.
There are very few world champions. You know, even that, if you just say the number, if you look at the number, I'm not sure we can figure it out, but that's a detail I don't care that much about at the moment. You know, there's only so many world championships in a world championship.
Yeah.
And of those, 99%+ of them are trained at camps with other lifters. You know, they're over the gym on a regular basis, other lifters. Very rare is the one who can be all by themselves and get very far.
Yeah, I know I've heard about, you know, like lone wolves in other sports, like in strongman, you know, they're just by themselves all the time. I don't know if I've personally ever heard of a weightlifter going to those high levels, and it's like, yeah, they just train in their garage by themselves.
Not in recent history. That used to actually be the norm.
Yeah, back when there weren't as many barbell clubs.
Yep. But that changed, and I think it is better to have the environment. You know, again, there's a few who can succeed without that, but I think even them, they're immersed in the right situation, they would have gone beyond what they did. Humans by nature are social beings. You don't have to force them to do that, with rare exception. There are some people that are anti-social, but that number is such a small number that it's almost meaningless. You don't have to have a lot of rules and laws. People want to fit in, for the most part. And that doesn't mean anarchy, but it does mean you don't have to do a lot to keep people in line. Don't do it on their own, to an extent.
Yeah.
No perfect. No system is perfect.
Yeah. Everyone likes to be around other people. You feed off of it. Even if the person isn't quite doing what you're doing, just the fact that they're there, it pushes you a whole different way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jim, for your own training, you know, we kind of talked about kind of as you developed from, you know, a younger lifter into a more mature lifter. What about transitioning from someone who's in the senior population into the masters? Did that change the way that you were training at all? Or have you just been, you know, lifting big the whole time or doing just the same amount of sessions? Did that change anything at all, transitioning into the masters category?
It changed gradually, and then there was a change after age 15 for me personally. That doesn't mean that's going to be that way for everybody. I did my school at 38, but I was still pulling more than 90% of that up until 50.
What was your, so you got your best lifts done at 38, you said?
Yeah, I did my total favorite kilos one time when I was 38. I snatched 130, clean jerk 170. Weighed about 102.7 at the time. And then it very gradually, I mean, it was not a straight line, but it gradually trended down. And then in my 50s, I've had a couple injuries that have been creeping in, and I think that's slowed me down a little bit. So my totals dropped way off last year. By the time I hit that last meet for the Grand Slam, my totals had dropped. But I was still, this last year, I don't know what my best total was. High 260s, low 270s, I think was where I could have been. And then that last week that the American Masters was supposed to meet for the Grand Slam, and I think I totaled, I don't remember now, 240.
Was that something that you had planned going into the year? Okay, I'm going to go after the Grand Slam, and I'm going to sign up for all these meets, or did it just kind of happen?
Once I realized it was a good see, it was a definite goal.
Oh, well, what, once you realized that it was obtainable?
Well, first I heard other people's money grabs for them, and then I saw where the meets were going to be. They were all close enough, and I knew, like, the big one was the World Championships. I'd never been to the World Championships until last year because they were in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. I could ride to them.
Really? That was your first Masters Championships?
Yes, that was my first Worlds, my first Masters Worlds. I would have loved to go on. In fact, this year, initially, they were supposed to be in Germany, and then that fell through, and then they were going to be in Orlando. And then, of course, that fell through because of the pandemic. But Germany is a lot more expensive to go to than Canada.
Yeah, that definitely. That's why we went. That was a great trip. That was a great trip and a great meet. Yeah.
Yep, so everything aligned. I guess that as much as lifting is my life's passion, I still work for a living. I'm a respiratory therapist, and I love that, too. I have two life passions, not having a life. Lifting and being a respiratory therapist, and I spend 20 hours a week or more doing that, and I did a lifetime PR in the squat when I was 48 or 49, and it's because I was laid off and not working.
All the time to squat in the world.
All the time in the world to squat and recover. And my recovery was like it's never been in my entire life, and I was feeling good. I squatted, 100 kilos.
How many kilos?
2.5 kilos or 240,
right
around 240, I think it was.
Yeah, and that's at, how old were you?
237.5, I think it was. I think it ended up being pounds. And that was a high bar squat. I did squat at 560 at low bar years ago, but low bar was not. For me, low bar is never carried over. But I was, I'd have to look it up. But I think I was 49.
So 49 years old, back squatting over 500 pounds. That's pretty darn impressive.
Which I know there are other people that were better lifters with lifting more than that. Believe that was a lifetime PR. Before that, I never squatted more than 500. I gained 35 pounds in that time that I was laid off.
Well, it just goes to show you, you know, like if you've got the time to do the training works, and if you take care of your body over years, your body will also still work. Like I remember the first meet in Elmira that I met you at, you also lifted. And yeah, I wasn't really too familiar with Masters lifters, other than the fact that most Masters athletes that I typically met weren't that flexible. And then I saw you snatching, and it's like, oh my goodness, like you had all the range of motion in the world. Like you've got a beautiful squat, and it just goes to show, like, it doesn't have to go away if you take care of it.
Right. Yep, and it's getting so, in order to maintain it, I do have to actually spend more. Because flexibility was always an easy thing. I had an aptitude for that right from the beginning. If I stretch, I could get away with not stretching for 3 months to a little split. Now, I have to stretch a little bit, or I'm starting to tighten up in place of whatever I used to. And I think that's something that can really start me until my 50s. I used to get a rack of bar, hands fully on the bar, not on my feet, just firing my hands and putting my elbows up. And the bar would be resting right on my collarbones.
You were born and made for weightlifting.
Yeah, at least for the flexibility part. I think I could have been stronger if I'd been able to train and had more time to recover. Working for a living, definitely. I worked a lot of 12-hour shifts over the years. I think that did not help my recovery. And recovery is, you got to train right, but recovery is almost a bigger deal.
What kind of things do you do or did you do to recover? You know, I'm sure you ate well, but like, were you doing, you know, any other types of therapies or things like that?
I would do a little bit of, I tried to massage when I could. I would do a little bit of rolling out, but not a lot, and I'd get, because it hurt, I'd get tired of doing it. But I would do it, and I would see some, you know, some results from that. Biggest thing I try to do is get sleep, but I just didn't always. I always wanted to do better than I did. A lot of those years when I was working those 12-hour shifts and still working out, I was running out 4 to 6 hours of sleep every night. And that's just not ideal.
No.
And I would try to beat y'all, but a lot of times it's I only got this much time. So, and I don't eat in McDonald's anymore, but I would then.
Well, it's, you know, you're only human, and you know, like you're I've heard people refer to before as like you're a blue collar lifter. You know, like you're working a full time job, you got a family, like you said before, and then but weightlifting is important. It's a big part of your life. It's a big passion. So there was always time for it, and of course you got to lift those weights. But it's like fitting in everything is a huge challenge when you're working a 12-hour shift.
Yeah, I mean, lifting weights for me personally kept me sane and kept me out of jail.
Yeah.
I had goals and I had a thing to do and I had something to lose. I didn't want to lose it.
Yeah. If you have a rough day at work, put it into the weights.
Exactly.
Well, Jim, what's, out of all these years of being involved in the sport as an athlete, what is one of the more meaningful moments for you in your career as an athlete?
As an athlete, just a handful of things. I'm still very fond of my highest total. I have a total of 300 kilos. It's probably in one way the highlight of my lifting career. There's been a couple of gold medals that I've won that were meaningful within the contest. I won the Empire State Games back when they still had those. And that was just very meaningful because at that time, I think that was the highest level I got to. Just winning the gold medal at that was pretty awesome.
So that would be the equivalent of New York State champion, right?
Pretty much, yeah. There was a lot of years there were no New York State champions. Everyone just went to the Empire State Games. That serves as a, whether it did officially or not, it didn't matter. It served as the New York State championships for a lot of years. Winning the Masters World Championships, it's up there pretty high. And one of the things, no matter where I place, if I do PRs or do the best list I can do on that day and I go 6 for 6, I love going 6 for 6.
Just a highly consistent day.
Yes. And I mean, that's lifts in meets or wasted lifts. And I don't like the waste lifts. I want to make lifts. Do I want to make more? Yes. But very, very few times have I thought they can go on 6 for 6. I've gone 6 for 6 more times at PRs until I've gotten older where I can't lift things I used to be able to do. But I still am pushing. This will still help you in these.
Yeah. Do you tend to go for PRs more in training or more at the meets? I know there's different camps out there.
Yeah, at
at meets.
PRs in strength movements in training. PR squat, PR pump squat, those have been done in training. PR snatch clean jerk. I think the first time I snatched 130, I had never snatched more than 122.5 in training.
Wow. How do you mentally approach something like that? You know, like I've seen a lot of lifters who are still developing where they, once we get over that threshold of their old PR and they know it, it's in their head, and they maybe they made all their lifts before that perfectly. All of a sudden, like that lift, it's like the chances that it's going to be a mislift skyrocket, not because it's heavier, but from the mental aspect. So how do you mentally prepare for a PR? And doing so in a competition, it seems is definitely way more stressful.
Yeah, well, and for me, I don't want to diminish the stressfulness. Even when things, everything goes well, it's still a certain amount of stress. But for me, that is the thrill. That's why I'm looking for ways to lift as much as I can. So when I have an opportunity to do a PR, I don't want to miss it. I want to make that lift, and it drives me on even more. It's talked about the first meet that I ever went to. Most I've done in training for clean jerk was about 230 pounds. I go to the meet, I clean jerk 115. I get 10 kilos more in the meet. And I had never even attempted that weight before to that meet.
So it drives you. It makes you push a little harder.
Yes. Yep.
Do you think that maybe too many lifters are playing it too safe, afraid to bomb out, afraid to go for things?
It depends on the lifter. For example of a good strategy for Kendrick Ferris at one point in time was very inconsistent in snatch and was, you know, his snatch was low enough into his clean jerk because he had a really good clean jerk. But he would very rarely make all three snatches. So then he just kind of settled in, backed off a little bit, and just every meet he'd go up 1 or 2 kilos. And he had like 5 or 6 meets in a row where he basically went up 1 or 2 kilos every time. And ultimately his top snatch, if he had done it sooner, he would have exceeded the U.S. record.
Wow.
Ended up his snatch was becoming pretty respectable. You know, well, I mean, it sounds like he was snatching terrible compared to a lot of people. He just wasn't snatching as good as his clean jerk. You know, there were a few people that were snatching pretty consistently, and then he'd get up and clean jerk, but he was getting harder and harder to beat in the U.S. because he was starting to snatch higher 160s. I think he ended up getting season at least 166 at one point. One time the record was 165, but Tony Elsa broke it before he got to that. But anybody was starting to make 2 or 3 snatches every time instead of one.
I seem to remember that. Was that was during back around 2015 era when everyone was trying to get on the world team?
I think it was. It was back in that time frame. Those last couple of years before his last Olympics, he started becoming more consistent in the snatch because he kind of changed his strategy a little bit to fit what he needed to do. For some of the lifters that snatch is their lift, and they can go in there and they can be way ahead. Other lifters just have to play the game and just be consistent and make lifts.
And that's kind of what he did, yeah.
Yeah. And for me, snatch has been come and go. There's been times when I just felt like that night after doing the same thing with snatch. I like to do the clean jerk and just go out there and everything disappears and go out there and next thing I know I'm getting the bounce signal. I didn't even know I did it.
Yeah.
But that happens for me. Clean jerk was always easier and it doesn't always happen with clean jerk, but most often would happen with clean jerk. With snatch, I'd be able to build up to it and I'd tell where I'm going. By the time the meet rolled around, everything's good. Other times it was just, I'm just tired of hanging on.
Do you, when you've done so many meets, you know, do you still get nervous at meets, you know, being, you know, like 100 plus in, or is it like kind of like a normal thing now?
It's gradually blending more towards a normal thing, but I still get nervous at every single meet I go to.
So it's, for anyone listening, it's totally normal.
You know, the thing about whether it's nervousness, anxiety, fear, anger, those are all potential tools. You can use them to your advantage, or they can use you.
Exactly. And you don't want them to use you. You want to be able to channel that into your lifting.
Yep, so you channel them, you control them. I don't try to fight my fear. I embrace it and guide it where I want it to go. Doesn't mean I don't get afraid. Doesn't mean I'm not nervous. It means I harvest it. It's not right in me.
And it seems, too, like you could kind of use that to your advantage and channel, whether it be fear, anger, frustration, whatever you're kind of feeling that day into your focus.
Pass to him. And that's one of the ways that I learned for lack of a better way to put it, overcome my fear, was that don't focus on fear. Focus on the task at hand. What is the job? What do I want to happen? My whole point of training and lifting is to make something happen. And that is what I'm striving to do. I focus on what I want to happen. Because what I don't want to happen will take care of itself. I don't need to help that. I need to help what I want to happen.
Yeah, exactly. I like that. What you don't want to have happen is it's going to happen all by itself. You don't have to force the issue.
Okay. I make plans. Okay, if this thing happens, what am I going to do? And then I leave it alone. Okay, this is what I'm shooting for. And then I'll walk along to this if I need to. If I don't need to do that, I can keep focusing on what I want to have.
I think it's an important thing for especially newer lifters or really anyone to really think about. You know, like some of my best meets have been when I almost felt the worst. And, you know, like, you go into it and you feel tired, you're run down, you're stressed out about X, Y, Z. and then you do your best lifting. It's like, well, how did that happen? Well, it's, you were able to move past whatever it was that was trying to bag you down.
I have done PRs that felt every ounce of it, and I don't even know how I made the lift, and it hurt, and it was just heavy, and I made it anyway. When I've done lifts where I've been in those moments where I'm already in the bouncing, but I don't even remember doing it.
It just happened so fast.
Yes. I like the ones where I don't feel it better.
Yeah, the ones where it doesn't feel like, you know, like it's all on your shoulders or your hips or your knees, and you can walk away from it just feeling great and maybe do that split. Well, how did that start with you doing a split after your last, I think it's pretty much your last lift, or maybe it's your last snatch and clean jerk?
Yeah, sometimes I'll do it after a record. The origins of that are back when I was first lifting weights. Everybody's saying how bad that is for you. You should do this to make your muscle bound. Here's my muscle bound. I can do a split.
And no one else can do a split.
It's just kind of a holdover from that. And it's also just that here I am in my 50s, I can still do a split.
Which is incredibly impressive. I don't think I can do a split. I haven't tried, but maybe I'll try after this.
When I turned 40, my goal was intended when I turned 50 to still be able to do a split, and I did that. Now, it's not as much a goal, but I'm sure hoping that when I hit 60, I still can. And there are people that can. You know who recently did a post on Facebook? Tim Swartz, who's older than I am, and bigger than I am, he can do a split.
Wow.
So I'm not the only flexible guy around. I am one of them, but I'm not the only one.
Well, it pays to be strong. And it pays to be flexible, especially as you start to go through your life and you get into, you know, your later years. That just means you're just going to be more resilient to anything that life has to throw at you.
Yes. Life's meant to be lived. Enjoy your life for as long as you can, and keeping things working helps that go on longer. Eventually, it's going to end even still, but if it wins life from 100 times, sooner or later, I did the best I could.
Exactly. Well, Jim, what's one piece of knowledge you would like to pass on to, you know, like it could be to lifters or coaches or just anyone? Like if there's one thing that you would write down and put it in a time capsule, it's like, this is the one thing, one piece of knowledge that I would like people to know many years from now, what would it be?
Try to find that balance between being earnest and impatient at the same time. It's a process. It's going to take a certain amount of time. That doesn't mean dog it and take it easy, but it means sometimes you just have to wait for the process to follow through.
You can't rush it.
You can't rush it. That doesn't mean you shouldn't work harder to make it happen. You can work. It is possible to work too hard.
Oh, yeah. I kind of feel like this is a harder thing in today. For some reason, like everything is so instant gratification, so immediate, you know, like if you wanted to know about weightlifting, you had to go to a library and find that book, you know, and now like I could just be on my phone and I can find all kinds of resources about weightlifting, good and bad, in a matter of minutes, you know, or seconds actually, and make a giant list of things. So it's how do you apply this to the modern day life? Yeah, it's tough. Well, Jim, thank you so much for coming on. This has been great. I'd love to get you back on the show eventually again. Is there anywhere that people can follow you?
I don't really have Instagram. I'm not going to post it. I'm still working full time. I'm still having family commitments. I am on Facebook, and I mostly just use that to garbage and have fun, but also lifting weights.
Awesome. So people can see videos of you lifting, stuff like that there. And also I'll say too, if you're at a weightlifting meet, it might be, maybe we're at the Arnold next year and you're out there, maybe it be at one of the big masters meets, or it could just be one that's in upstate New York or in New York period. You know, you typically travel around to a lot of the meets. If anyone sees you there, say hello to Jim. He will help you. Like he's essentially the community's coach. You know, if you were like that's one of the best things that I love about you, Jim, is you'll talk to everybody versus that sometimes at a meet, it kind of seems like everyone's a little standoffish, you know, like no one knows each other, but you'll make friends with everybody. You'll help everybody and you'll offer, you know, advice to anyone who will take it. And I think if you're a coach and you see Jim at a meet, say, you know, like say hello, pick his brain, have him look at your lifter, you know, because it's always good to have another set of eyes on your lifter. And it's just you're someone that everyone should know, Jim. That's one of the big reasons why I wanted to get you on this podcast.
Thank you, James. I appreciate that. I take that as a compliment. And that's a side effect of who I am. It's not my main goal to be everybody's friend, but I'm happy that I can fit in.
Oh yeah, and for me viewing you as a role model, it's something that, you know, that I try to strive to do too. You know, talk to people, be a little more friendly, you know, like if you don't know people, you know, it seems like it's the right way to go about things. So thank you for that influence, Jim. And thank you again for coming on the show.
You're welcome. Good to talk to you, James. And I'll talk to you again, I hope.
Oh yeah. And for anyone listening still at this point, we're at an hour in, be sure to go on to Instagram and follow the Barbell Strikes Back. Follow me, James A. McDermott. Go on to Apple Podcasts, leave a 5-star review if you think I deserve it. And thank you again for listening. Thank you one more time, Jim.
You're welcome. Have a good day, James.
Thank you. You too.